And now we interrupt this bankruptcy already in progress for a word from our sponsor.
GM is getting down to business. Because the only chapter we're focused on is Chapter 1.
When Chapter 11 bankruptcy is done, General Motors would be happy to have Chapter 1, Page 1, or even Square 1. Selling you on its future, GM wants to know if you're buying. Like a rock. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, June 10th. Coming up, a great conversation about how the style of advertising changes in hard economic times, including General Motors. I'm John Huckaberry here with Farai today. Good morning, Farai.
Hi, John. How you doing? Well, coming up this hour, we're launching a special series on the fight to fix your commute. You'll meet visionary hackers of transportation, hear about the debate, and we're going to talk about a judge and talk with a judge with a taste for unusual punishment.
But it's not cruel.
Not cruel.
Just unusual.
All this and more ahead, but first, the morning's headlines.
And in the headlines, some of the final barriers to Chrysler's restructuring plans are now gone. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to Italian carmaker Fiat's bid to buy Chrysler, and a bankruptcy court approved the plan to terminate nearly 800 dealer franchise agreements. Auto analyst Harley Shaken says the whole industry is watching what happens next.
Chrysler's an iconic company, and what happens and how this is resolved will have broad precedent, not simply at General Motors, but at auto suppliers and perhaps at other industries as well.
Maybe Chrysler will have better luck selling icons rather than cars. Chrysler says it will close the Fiat deal shortly. General Motors is also cutting off hundreds of dealers, but a handful of them can stay on. GM says 20 dealers will be allowed to stay open, but 1,100, sticker shock, they're out of business.
All right, I guess you'll have to drive a long way then to find the dealers that are open. The Obama administration is getting help from a lush island on a sticky political problem. The Pacific island of Palau says it will take in up to 17 Guantanamo Bay detainees. The prisoners are Chinese Muslims, members of the Uyghur minority. The Pentagon says they were not enemy combatants, but they can't be released to China because they might face persecution. A court order ordered them released into the United States, but that was politically unpopular here. And the U.S. is actually still looking for countries to take dozens of other Gitmo detainees who have been cleared. Iraqi officials say at least 32 people are dead and dozens more wounded after a car bomb ripped through a market in the south region of the country. It hit a Shiite area. It's the latest in a series of high-profile explosions rocking the country as the U.S. military prepares to leave Iraqi cities by the end of the month.
And they're also cleaning up the aftermath of a horrific bombing yesterday, suicide bombing yesterday in Pakistan. In sports, the L.A. Lakers are still in the driver's seat in the NBA Finals, but the Orlando Magic are coming back. They won last night. It was a fascinating game to watch. The Lakers now hold a 2-1 edge in the series. The next game is tomorrow night, and there will be a Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Finals. The Penguins won last night. It's 3-3. The final game is Friday. So we're talking this morning to a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. Unusual, not cruel.
I would definitely have the white-collar worker work as a blue-collar worker for 2, 3, 4 years, depending on the nature of the crime.
That's right. We're making you the judge. Come up with a creative sentence, won't you, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've gotten some great ones.
Absolutely.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I went around a train station, waiting for that train.
Thank you, Jimi Hendrix. Good morning, everyone. Waiting for the train. In a sense, we're all waiting for the train as we begin the task of rethinking, for energy reasons, for environmental reasons, for economic reasons, rethinking how we live in America's cities. All week long, we're waiting for the train. You can wait for the train right with us here on The Takeaway. It's our series on rethinking urbanism in America. And Matt Dellinger, transportation writer, friend of The Takeaway, what are you doing in Denver?
Hello, John. Basically, I guess I'm on a safari of sorts. I'm in Denver for the Congress for the New Urbanism, which is a yearly conference of sort of the leading progressive planners and architects and activists. And every year they pick a city and they go there and meet and they use the city as their laboratory. And so for the next few days, I too will be sort of wandering around and not wandering, purposefully walking around, driving even. And talking to people about the changes happening here.
Oh, that's great. Just don't get arrested, okay, as long as you're doing it. The idea of just Matt Dellinger sort of doing a safari in the middle of Denver scares me a little bit. Let's hear the voices of some of the people you met on the train ride you took from where to where?
Well, I got on in San Francisco, Emeryville to be exact.
All right. Well, here's the voice of Bill Lynn. Explain to me what this is all about.
We used to have the ability to go from any place in America to anywhere else in America, this is recently as the 1950s, without a car and without flying. That is an enormously important national security safety net, and the basis of it is streetcars within cities and passenger trains between cities.
So, Matt Dellinger, who is Bill Lynn, and are we going backwards or forwards here in this new urbanism mission?
Well, they might be the same thing. Bill Lynn is a director at the Free Congress Foundation. It's a sort of ultra-conservative think tank, and he has been for a while now an advocate for rail and transit, which is a rare breed among conservatives, and he does see it as a national security issue. But, you know, I also happen to know he loves trains because we rode the California Zephyr in these historic old cars. They were dome-top cars.
Oh, fabulous.
Called the Silver Solarium, right through the canyons and the mountains. It was amazing. And the entire he was on for much of the time, and he was just thrilled, and he ordered us all Brandy's Alexander because they were the favorite drink of his favorite railroad writer.
That was a throwback. E.M.
Frimbo.
Well, yeah, we want to get you started on your safari this morning. We actually have the mayor of Denver to talk to in just a moment. So get started on your safari. We're going to look at the infrastructure and start rethinking American cities all week long here on The Takeaway. The New Urbanists, that's the name of these guys?
Yes, the Congress for the New Urbanists.
Congress for the New Urbanists. All week long, we're waiting for the train. Matt Dellinger, thanks so much. And because we are in Denver for this event and kicking off this series this morning, John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver, who's already been working to make big changes in and around his city, spoke with us. And I asked him whether he thinks being the mayor is the way to go for inspiring big changes, making changes in the way Americans live and work.
I think mayors are where the real change is starting. If you look at sustainability all across the country and really across the world, it was generally in mayors, in the office of mayors, that where people first started saying, how can we use less energy? How can we still maintain a quality of life and yet change our consumption patterns?
Well, let's talk about an example that you are familiar with. When you took office in 2003, you set to work on the Fast Tracks system, right? It's a light rail project that connects Denver to its fancy airport, right?
Well, and to all of our suburbs, it's actually six different lines that kind of arc out like the spokes of a wheel.
How can a mayor be a leader in a process like that politically when you have so many other political entities that you have to get on board?
Well, part of it is just collaboration. When I ran for mayor, a lot of the suburban mayors, some of them had given me advice when I was contemplating running, they were receptive to me coming out and talking to them and building relationships. So when we actually went to the voters in 2004 to ask for a 0.4-cent sales tax increase to build this new system, 119 miles of new track, we had all 32 mayors, so two-thirds of them Republicans, but from big cities like Denver and our neighbor to the east, Aurora, but also little teeny towns like Centennial and Foxfire, all 32 mayors unanimously supported that tax increase. And I think that's that sense of collaboration is what you really need to make things like this work.
Well, what you're describing also is evidence that these issues of sustainability and how the infrastructure supports or actually inhibits living in a city has suddenly emerged as a real issue. Listen to this. Here's Bill Vidal, manager of public works in Denver, and this is something he said in a PBS documentary called Road to the Future.
The Denver area started getting national rankings for congestion. And so it started at about 20th, and then it went to 15th, then it went to 7th. And at one time, we were actually number 3. All of a sudden, what used to be a half-hour rush hour became a 2 or 3 hour rush hour in the morning and a 2 or 3 hour rush hour in the afternoon.
John Hickenlooper, how has this become a real issue for Denverites in the sense that they're actually going to vote for things that are going to result in significant changes in the way they live?
You know, Denver is kind of the northern bulge of the Sun Belt, and we have a very high percentage of people that chose to live here, not for a job promotion or a career opportunity, but just for the quality of life. And I think that high percentage of people that came here for the quality of life makes them more willing to invest and to try and preserve and maintain that quality of life.
And once you get this sort of rail system in place, it's really just the beginning. There are harder projects ahead, correct?
Well, exactly. You have to keep building forward. Once we get fast tracks in place, you have to fill it in. It's just the bare skeleton. Bill Vidal, who you just heard, he used to be the head of the State Department of Transportation and then used to run our regional planning agency. He released last fall, the city of Denver released, a strategic transportation plan that instead of looking at car trips and do we need more lanes or exit lanes or whatever, it looks at person trips and treats all the major parts of the city as travel sheds, just like watersheds, but as collectors of people. So whether someone's using a bicycle or walking or using light rail and then a bicycle, the key is to really try and devise a system where it's not just all about the automobile.
Well, that describes sort of the decision that was made some years ago to create a beltway around Denver, which it turned out to be simply an exacerbator of all the problems it was trying to solve. How do cities avoid something like that?
I think cities have to recognize that the density is not a bad thing if done properly. So part of what we did with fast tracks, building this 119 miles of new track, is to, instead of taking it right out to the middle of the suburbs and putting a big parking lot around the stations, we designed it so that most of the stops are in old factory sites, old brownfields where the factory's been closed down, but there's a big open piece of land. And then whether it's in Denver or one of the suburbs, we worked very hard to get the zoning increased so people could build 4 and 6 and 8 story buildings with offices and housing and retail, and people could get a very high level of choices and a high quality of life traveling from one station to the next. That's the vision for the future.
And really, it is about vision. What gives you the confidence that this vision is going to be any better at predicting the future ways people are going to live than the past?
Well, you could never be certain of what the next generation is going to value. But certainly when we went out and talked to the suburban mayors and did focus groups with their citizens, we concentrated on, you know, even if the light rail line never comes to your suburb, you don't want to sit in traffic jams. No one likes sitting on a hot asphalt highway, you know, waiting for the person in front of them to move 4 feet. And our goal was to say, all right, if we get more people off their cars and into light rail, then the people that really benefit are those who are still driving in, but now, you know, get 20 or 30 extra minutes every day that they can spend either with their family or at work.
Mayor, if Denver can solve these problems, what's the lesson for communities around the United States?
Well, as you said at the beginning, we are a bit of a laboratory. And I think there is that very high level of civic engagement here. People collaborate from, you know, one suburb to the next to the downtown. And what we're really demonstrating, I think, is that if people listen and work together, they can accomplish things that would have even, you know, 10 or 15 years ago been considered impossible.
The mayor of Denver, Colorado, John Hickenlooper, he is quite literally waiting for the train, the light rail system that's going to transform that community. Matt Dellinger, so how are you going to sort of see in your trips around Denver exactly what the mayor is talking about there?
Well, interestingly, I'm going to go on one tour led by the Congress for the New Urbanism that looks at some of those stations he was talking about where they had to increase the zoning because you have a light rail line going out into the suburbs and it calls for a different kind of land use. I'm also going to be looking around the neighborhoods of Lodo, lower downtown, which used to be a kind of skid row, and it's now the first thing I saw when I stepped off the train was a Morton Steakhouse, so things have changed.
Well, the retrofitting of American cities is a dual process. It's about the outlying communities, which is what the light rail system is that the mayor was talking about, but it's also like rehabbing in a responsible way the inner cities, and that's what the Lodo is all about. All week long,
exactly.
We are waiting for the train and taking a look at cities using Denver as a laboratory. Matt, don't get into any trouble now, all right?
You guys will bail me out. Won't you?
Oh, you know, you're right, actually. We will bail you out. Matt Dellinger, our safari guide for the New Urbanist Convention in Denver. The pros and cons of new urbanism all week long on The Takeaway as we rethink American cities. We are waiting for the train. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea. If you commit the crime, you have to do the time. Now, in grade school, John, were you ever forced to write on a chalkboard or anything like that?
Yeah, I actually liked doing that, but
that's why it didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work. Look how I turned out.
Well, anyway, a federal judge in the U.S. District Court has upped the ante. S.A. as punishment becomes writing a full book. The judge who gave that quixotic, or is that pedantic, ruling joins us now, Judge Ricardo Urbina of the United States District Court in Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have to admit, this is completely inspired, but let me just start with the facts. You gave a sentence to Andrew Bodner, Dr. Andrew Bodner. What was the case about?
The case involved situation in where two pharmaceutical companies entered into an agreement, a non-competitive agreement, that when reviewed by the Federal Trade Commission, required that the individuals involved, specifically the defendant, provide a declaration as to whether or not the agreement would unduly compromise the consumer. The statement indicated one thing, but later on the Federal Trade Commission realized that the statement was false. He was charged and then pled guilty.
Okay, so I understand it was a misdemeanor. Originally, he was charged with a felony. And how did you come up with the idea of saying, I want you to write a book? And what instructions did you give? How do you deliver the injunction to me as if I were him?
Well, I indicated that sentencing involves four factors, which the judge reviews and then balances in light of the circumstances and facts of the case. One of them is rehabilitation, the other is retribution, then there's incapacitation and deterrence. I indicated to Mr. Bodner that in light of his background, in light of his skills and education, and in light of the fact that this appeared to be an aberration, I was prepared to put him on probation for 2 years, requiring him to pay a $5,000 fine, but because the law seeks to promote respect for the law, and because sentencing is a vital aspect of that process, I directed him to write a book that would be useful to other persons similarly situated to him in the future, so that other persons who are confronted with the same or similar circumstances would not get involved with unlawful behavior.
Okay, Judge, that gets you the retribution part, it seems to me, but what about the deterrence? Is there a little deterrence in here as well?
Well, yes, I believe so. Deterrence has two parts. It's the deterrent to the individual who committed the crime and then deterrence to the general public. This person, Mr. Bodner, a very well-educated fellow, is now going to have to sit down and dissect how he got in trouble and understand it to the extent that not only he can comprehend it, but that he can write it in a way so others will comprehend it. And I feel that that's going to be a task that will take him quite a substantial amount of time and an investment in effort.
Judge, I have to ask this. When you come up with a sentence like this and deliver it to a defendant, what does your gut want their reaction to be? No, Judge, not that, anything but that? Or do you want him to say, yes, you're right, I'll do it?
Well, of course, the latter is the better of the two alternatives, because showing remorse and taking responsibility for the act is certainly a part of the process we look forward to having the defendant accept. So in this case, actually, we discussed the issue of a book, of writing a book, and he did not seem at all put off by the fact that he would have to invest a considerable amount of time in writing something that I was going to read.
Okay. So in a second, we want to ask you about a completely different case with some news implications that you ruled on. But in order to wrap up the book business, you actually did this with a lobbyist already. So you've got two books in production or produced. Do you want to read these books?
Well, the first book was required of an individual who pled guilty. About 1998, he was an active lobbyist. I required him to write a book that would address the Federal Election Campaign Act and one that would be instructive to other lobbyists. To be perfectly honest, I was not very interested in reading that book. But in the current circumstances, I think this individual will write something that I will, in fact, be interested in reading.
All right. Well, Judge Urbino, you also ruled in a very, very different case. You ordered the Bush administration to release 17 Uyghurs who are now on their way to Palau. But it was a battle over their fate. Did you think that it would happen as quickly as it did? We're talking, of course, about Chinese Muslims held in Guantanamo Bay. Why did you rule that way? Did you think that they would be moved this quickly? Very briefly, please.
Well, it wasn't really so quick. These individuals, many of whom were detained since 2001 and 2005, have been held, and for a while their situation looked desperate because no country was willing to accept them. However, with the new administration, I got the firm sense that things were moving and efforts were being made, and I'm very glad to know that these efforts have now been successful.
All right. Well, it's certainly a fascinating case, and I'm sure that you're following the progress of those Uyghurs as they're transported.
Yes, I'm following the progress. These are individuals who are determined not to be enemy combatants, persons who I felt under the circumstances should have had their freedom some time ago, given the government certification that they were not enemy combatants.
And that could be a book in and of itself. Judge Ricardo Urbina of the U.S. District Court in Washington, thanks very much. And we want to hear your take. If you had the power to do what Judge Urbina did, what would you do?
My name is Carla. I'm calling, listening on WEAA-FM on Route 1 heading towards D.C. I would make that person live deep in the inner city, deep, deep, deep in the hood, so that he can or she can see how the people who have no means live.
And of course, Carla is calling from my home city of Baltimore. What would you do if you could decide what a white collar criminal could do? We've had great responses. 877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Femi.
It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. Chrysler's bankruptcy case could wrap up today, and last night the Supreme Court cleared the way for its deal with Fiat. In Detroit, General Motors has a new CEO. The government's auto task force handpicked the former AT&T head, Edward Whittaker Jr., to take over at GM. The Boston Globe is reporting that the New York Times Company has hired Goldman Sachs to manage the possible sale of the cash-strapped newspaper. The report says that Goldman Sachs is accepting bids for the Globe, and its union rejected a deal to cut salaries. Now, the New York Times Company owns our partner, the New York Times. In Pakistan, rescue workers are searching the rubble for missing people after a suicide bomb hit a luxury hotel in Peshawar, killing at least 15. Two UN workers were killed in the blast. Let's look at some top stories from the news headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we've been talking this morning about a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. Now, if you had that judge's powers and could sentence one of the people who helped bring down the economy, say, who would you sentence and what would you sentence them to? We want you to be creative. There is no physical punishment allowable here, but maybe you could have some cleaning out sewer systems.
Jumping jacks.
Yep, teaching unruly third graders. Tell us your take, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Eating broccoli. Yes, we were talking with Judge Urbina not only about his unique way of sentencing white-collar criminals, but also about the final disposition of the case of the Uyghurs. It's not a sentence exactly. It's a resettlement. The tiny South Pacific island state of Palau has agreed to temporarily resettle 17 Chinese Muslims being held in Guantanamo Bay Prison. The men are ethnic Uyghurs from China's northwestern Xinjiang province who've been cleared for release 4 years ago by Judge Urbina. They've not been sent back to China for fear they'd be mistreated, and there's been fierce political opposition to their being released in the U.S., at least until Barack Obama was inaugurated. But Palau's current president, Johnson Torabong, said his country was honored and proud to take the detainees on this tiny island about 500 miles off the coast of the Philippines. He stepped down in January of this year. Former President Tommy Remigasao joins us. As the former president of Palau, do you agree with this notion of being honored and proud to take these Uyghur resettled detainees from Guantanamo? Good morning.
Good morning. And first of all, this is obviously a very delicate and sensitive situation for us. While we are a small island country with a very small population, and we do have our island hospitality, this is something that we really should understand what we're getting ourselves into, what are the long-term ramifications for getting ourselves into hosting these Guantanamo Bay detainees, especially when you consider that we rely solely on a tourism industry that could have some negative effects on hosting such individuals.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Why would the resettlement of these 17 Chinese Muslims in Palau affect the tourism business from your perspective as a former president?
Well, we have to understand first that the Guantanamo Bay has been a sticky issue not just for us but around the world, and to date no country has agreed to host these people. And the important thing for us, of course, is that we must understand the hosting is easier, is the easy part. It's the long-term ramification. What is the view of the very people that we're trying to invite to Palau as tourists? What will they think of Palau if they know that we are hosting Guantanamo Bay detainees, you know?
Well, let's talk about this from a sort of regional political perspective. I mean, Palau doesn't recognize the People's Republic of China and still maintains diplomatic relations with Taiwan as the representative of the Chinese nation. Is it likely that this decision to take the Uyghurs is inflammatory, would be viewed as inflammatory to the government in Beijing?
Well, that's another issue to take, but we have, of course, on record saying that this two-China political issue is up to the two Chinas to decide. I mean, we would recognize both countries if it was possible, but for now we do recognize Taiwan, and we do want to work with mainland China. The biggest reason apparently for accepting these people is cooperation. Through our very close cooperation and relationship with the United States. But we're already doing that by having our sons and daughters fight alongside the U.S. Troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. So this is really not the sole way that we can cooperate with our close ally, the United States. But again, what I'm saying at this moment in time is that this situation has not been fully explained to our people. Even as I speak, Congress is not fully aware of what the details of the arrangements is. For example, when you say temporarily, how long is the temporary period? Because it could be a temporary permanent situation, as has been the case in some similar situations before.
Sir,
so this is obviously not a small issue. And please bear in mind that we are a nation of 20,000 people only. Tourism is our only industry. We are friendly, but we want to give that image of being a peaceful place that everybody can come to and feel relaxed.
Do you see it more as you're someone who served two terms? Your father was also president of Palau at one point. Do you see this as almost an affront to your country's sovereignty that you are taking these people in at the urging of the United States, or do you see this as totally voluntary?
To tell you the truth, the timing is very coinciding with the coming to the end of our financial agreements under a special treaty called the Compact of Free Association. So we have to renegotiate this financial package again. If we don't, everything runs out in 2009. So we're in a situation where we do want to assure the United States that we are indeed an ally that they can depend on. But I think the important thing really at this point in time is what is the long-term ramification? What will the impact have on our security, our economic dependence on the tourism industry?
Well, and the timing is pretty interesting here. Tommy Remengensau, former president of Palau, thanks for joining us. The former president of Palau was talking to us about the decision of the current president of Palau, Johnson Torabong, to take 17 resettled Chinese Muslims, the Uyghurs, being held in Guantanamo Bay. And now Femi Okay has the headlines.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Getting this news in the last 20 minutes or so, the U.S. trade deficit is heading upward for a second straight month in April as the gap between U.S. imports and exports grew. Now, analysts say that this reflects rising oil prices. Now, earlier this morning, the price of a barrel of oil shot above $70, and that's the highest it's been this year. Chrysler's bankruptcy proceedings could wrap up today. Fiat says it will sign on its deal with Chrysler as soon as the company is out of legal limbo. On Capitol Hill, the Obama administration is ready to issue new guidelines for how top financial executives can be compensated. The White House wants to give the SEC the authority to set those guidelines, which could limit bonuses to top executives to one-third of their annual salary. And from paying bankers to paying actors, a drawn-out labour squabble that could have shut Hollywood down is over. Members of the Screen Actors Guild overwhelmingly voted to sign a new contract. The contract raises pay, adds benefits, and gives actors new compensation for web material. That is a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much.
That is Virginia State Senator R. Cree Deeds, who won Virginia's three-way Democratic primary for governor yesterday. He handily and to some surprisingly beat former Democratic National Committee Chairman Terry McAuliffe. Deeds will now face Republican Bob McDonnell. So what does this say about the state of Virginia politics in one of the few states where Republicans have a shot at taking the executive? We're here now with Beverly Amsler, morning anchor for WVTF Radio in Roanoke, Virginia. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by you painting just very quickly a picture of Virginia. You know, I grew up in Maryland, but Virginia has at least two or three states within Virginia politically, doesn't it?
That's correct. There's Northern Virginia, which votes usually Republican. In fact, the entire state usually goes Republican, especially for presidential elections. In fact, in the 2008 presidential election, Virginia voted Democratic for the first time in more than four decades. And so many of the key candidates for that office came here to stump for that office while they were campaigning last year.
Virginia, obviously an incredibly powerful state, long history, and this was a three-way race. How did Deeds stack up in terms of financing and profile against the other candidates at first?
At first, the other candidates received more money than Cree Deeds did. They seemed to get involved in a little tit-for-tat controversy over the past couple of weeks, which Cree Deeds stayed out of. He is the only candidate that had previously run for statewide office, having lost to Bob McDonnell in 2005 for a state attorney general. So I think he had perhaps name recognition coming into this race yesterday.
You know, some people are saying that this is a rebuke to Terry McAuliffe.
Yes.
John is saying.
Yes.
Yes, Terry McAuliffe, who was such a huge factor during the Clinton years, big moneymaker. And in fact, there were some controversies about how he raised money. But I want to actually move ahead and talk a little bit about the next leg of the campaign. Deeds is now going to face off against Republican Bob McDonnell. And here's a statement from a video clip that McDonnell released last night.
Cree ran a great campaign. It was a tough primary, and I have to say, I'm sorry to see it end. And Cree, after your victory, I'd say take a break. You deserve it. Long vacation. Relax for a few months. Take some time off.
Okay, that is hilarious. So what do we expect from McDonnell?
Well, I don't think that you could set this race up any more particularly great. It's you couldn't have written it any better with Cree Deeds, who lost to Bob McDonnell 4 years ago for state attorney general, lost by 323 votes cast, by 323 votes out of about 2 million cast.
Wow.
You've got a candidate from affluent Northern Virginia, Bob McDonnell, from rural Southwest Virginia, Cree Deeds. So it's going to be an interesting several months until November 3rd.
You'll have plenty to talk about, right?
Oh, you bet.
But not Terry McAuliffe anymore.
No. Actually, Bill Clinton did stump for him here. I think he perhaps was seen as an outsider because of being tied to Bill and Hillary Clinton.
I did hear the phrase carpetbagger invoked, but I did not invoke it. So, Beverly, thanks so much. We will be watching
your
state.
You're quite welcome.
Beverly Amsler, morning anchor for WVTF Radio in Roanoke, Virginia.
Bill Clinton is still tied to Hillary Clinton, last I heard.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, here with John Hockenberry, and in a second with Femi Okay, but wanted to talk to you about our conversation with a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. We want to know, if you had his power and could come up with a creative sentence for a white-collar criminal, who would you sentence, and what would you have that person do? Now, Louise writes to us, these white-collar criminals should have to work as career advisors and tutors in public schools across the country, ones in lower-income communities. They should see children not fortunate enough to have been born into their own economic stratum. Well, we've had a lot of great responses. You can hear them at thetakeaway.org. Tell us your own at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Femi?
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The latest Guantanamo Bay development comes from more than 9,000 miles away. The Pacific island of Palau says it will take in up to 17 Guantanamo detainees. These are Chinese Muslims and members of the Uyghur minority. The Pentagon said that they were not enemy combatants some time ago, but they can't be released to China because they might face persecution. A court ordered them released into the US, but that was politically unpopular. The White House says that it's confident that a Guantanamo Bay detainee can be tried securely in New York. Ahmad Galani is the first prisoner brought to America. He's entering the same court that tried the 1993 World Trade Center bombing case. The Obama administration refuses to speculate on what would happen to Galani if he's acquitted, calling that a hypothetical. General Motors is cutting off hundreds of dealers, but a handful of them can now stay on. GM says that up to 20 dealers will be allowed to stay open. The franchise agreements held by dealerships to sell Chrysler, Dodge or Jeep vehicles will be terminated. Betty Jo Rosen works at a Viking Dodge dealership in Crystal Lake, Illinois, and she was distraught when she heard the news.
I'm praying every day for somebody to realize what's going on. It's just so wrong. And to do something to stop the cycle from happening. I mean, where's hope? Where's believing in what we voted for?
GM is ending deals with some 1,100 dealerships. Obstacles in Chrysler's path to restructuring are clearing out thanks to the courts. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to Italian carmaker Fiat's bid to buy Chrysler. And a bankruptcy court approved the plan to terminate nearly 800 dealer franchise agreements. So that's a look at some big stories making news this morning. John Fry.
Thank you, Femi. So it's always a great morning when we've got Cindy Gallup in the studio. She's the best-dressed person in radio, I think it's fair to say. Advertising consultant, former chairman of the ad agency BBH. A lot to talk about here. I wanted to start with something that an ad exec said to me last week, Cindy, which is as these car bailouts emerge day to day, week to week, and cash comes out of the TARP and over to General Motors, for instance, some of that money actually ends up at ad agencies that make the ads that we continue to see for cars on television. Is there kind of a bailout for the ad industry going on alongside this whole car industry financial debacle?
Well, unfortunately, there isn't, because the ad industry continues to be under enormous pressure in these very tough times. So, no, it's not benefiting them at all, I hasten to add.
But you are following it pretty closely, because a lot of the accounts are dependent upon the status of whether these companies are bankrupt or not.
No, absolutely. And, in fact, what is happening in the car industry has tremendous ramifications for the advertising agencies that work with them.
Well, among the ramifications, of course, is the style of the ads. I mean, how do you come up with an ad in economic hard times, and where does the rule book go in this environment? Listen to this.
Domino's oven-baked sandwiches beat the taste of Subway's 2-1. Then Subway's lawyers sent us this letter demanding we pull our commercials off the air. I was going to burn the letter, but everything's better when it's oven-baked.
It's the latest advertising campaign by Domino's chief rival, Subway Sandwiches. So as the economy begins to decline, are the gloves coming off in the ad world?
They are indeed, and it's a huge mistake, John, because
really?
What I tend to say is that many things that are true in life are also true in business. And a fundamental life truth is that we are enormously attracted to confidence. At any party, the biggest group of people will be around the person who projects most self-belief and self-confidence. The same is true of business. It's the brands that project most confidence in themselves, that can sell themselves on their own merits and not attack the competition, that ultimately will succeed.
Well, so wait a minute. You're saying that I may be really entertained by an attack ad, but I'm less likely to go and buy a product from the company that's making the ad?
Well, I think the inherent danger in attack ads, interestingly, is best exemplified by a tactic in the rivetingly appalling reality show Temptation Island. You may remember this from a few years ago, the show that dropped a number of theoretically committed straight couples into a tropical paradise and then hived the men off into a camp full of gorgeous women and the women off into a camp full of gorgeous men and sent them on dates and put them in the way of temptation. One of the brilliantly evil things the producers did in that show was before they did that, the male half of the couple was allowed to stipulate two guys that the female half could not go on dates with, and the female half was allowed to do the same with the girls. What that had the effect of was making each half of the couple instantly massively interested in the people that the other half of the couple had said they couldn't date. So actually, the danger in attack ads is that when you highlight a competitor, people go, wow, you know, they're obviously worried. That competitor's worth looking at. Let's check them out.
You got to have a degree in psychology to be in the ad business, that's for sure. Okay, so here's a friendly approach.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Action! 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 Zintite, you okay?
No, I'm not okay. I have that virus that's going around.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you better stay back. This one's a doozy.
That's okay, I'll be fine.
No, no, do not be a hero. Last year, there were 114,000 known viruses for PCs.
PCs? Not Macs. So, you just grab this
one. I think I got a crash.
Hey, if you feel like that'll help, good.
Okay, Cindy Gallup, it's fabulously entertaining. Does that work? It technically qualifies as a Mac attack ad, right?
Absolutely. And it's one of two of the most successful examples of this genre, the other one being Coke versus Pepsi. In the case of Mac versus PC, they have three things going for them. The first is that they absolutely took on a fundamental cultural fact that people make a choice between Mac and PC. Secondly, Apple is coming from the challenger brand position, so there's a very clear framework for why it will be doing this. And thirdly, it's done in an enormously entertaining and witty way. In the ad industry, it's absolutely never just what you do, it's the way that you do it. Mm. And they've done it brilliantly.
They have done it absolutely brilliantly. But what do you think, we don't have tape of it, but the sort of reverse ads, which say basically, you know, they're PC ads that say for the half the price of a Mac, you can get the same functionality with a PC. Do you like those in the way that they're done? Or?
Well, the interesting thing there is that they're going in on a purely rational proposition, and they haven't done it with the charm and the wit and the entertainment value that the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC campaign has.
But it's the great fight between the rational proposition. Because, I mean, Macs actually weigh more than PCs.
Person.
They weigh more. Macs are heavier than PCs, even though the guy in the commercial is lighter. And as you say, they do
but
cost more.
But they're shiny.
Yeah. Well, what's the ad challenge for this really serious problem that GE has to deal with here? Let's listen to a little of this.
Let's be completely honest. No company wants to go through this. But we're not witnessing the end of the American car. We're witnessing the rebirth of the American car.
General Motors trying to say, hey, we're still here. Does that work?
I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, John, about things are true in life, are true in business. In life, when somebody is apologizing for what they've done previously and saying they'll be better going forwards, we look for two things to assure us that they're sincere. We look for the tone of voice that demonstrates sincerity, and we look for them to demonstrate what they're saying through their actions. In my view, this advertising that is running currently is adopting exactly the same declamatory tone of voice that was used in much better times, and we're not currently yet seeing the actions that demonstrate they mean what they're saying. That, to me, is the drawback of that approach in advertising.
So it doesn't project confidence, and you say that's the key?
It's less, in this particular case, we're not looking for them to project confidence, actually. We're looking for them to be utterly sincere about the fact that they've screwed up and things are going to be different going forwards. So, and that is not what's coming through.
So sincerity precedes confidence. Just one of the rules to live by, according to Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant and former chairman of the advertising agency, BBH. Thanks so much. That was fascinating.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Great to be here as always.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. And also, we spoke this morning to a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. We want to hear your ideas. If you had that kind of power, what would you do? Who would you tell to do it? We've had a lot of thoughts.
My creative punishment would involve the convicted working an average wage job while caring for three foster children of school age. And ultimately, the foster kids would give the pass-fail determination of whether the care provided fulfilled the sentence.
Oh, boy.
That's our pal Troy, I think. He's overthought this.
Wow. Well, you know, I don't know. Those kids could be tough judges.
Yes,
and,
that's
you know,
true.
You can hear all of the responses at thetakeaway.org. Tell us your own, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I got a creative one. How about prison? Just send them to maximum security prison.
Oh, come on. That's old school. All right. We also kicked off a series on the new urbanism, redesigning communities so we can walk more, drive less. And some of you say you already are part of that.
My name is Ammon. I'm calling from Salt Lake City. I'm a new urbanist. I commute solely by bicycle. I don't like cars because I think they eat up your money, they make you fat, they destroy the environment, they support unethical dictators, and they contribute to crappy strip malls.
All right. Definitely.
Calling all new urbanists.
Has a point of view, and we want to hear yours too. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'll take African-American smoking habits for 100, Dave.
Why do black people love menthol so much?
I don't know. That's great.
That is correct. No one knows.
It's more than a Dave Chappelle joke. 75% of African-American smokers choose menthol cigarettes. The way they're advertised may be part of why.
Cool snow, fresh cool taste, so clean, so refreshing, smoke.
Now Congress wants the FDA to regulate tobacco. Clean Air Action on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, June 10th, the ins and outs of menthol cigarettes on The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John, how are you? Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about Pakistan, how the latest fighting is affecting American communities, Pakistani-American communities, in surprising ways. Gitmo comes to America. We are looking at the challenges of trying Guantanamo Bay detainees in New York. All this and more ahead, but first, the top headlines.
And in the headlines, Chrysler's road to restructuring is a lot clearer this morning. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to Italian carmaker Fiat's bid to buy Chrysler, and a bankruptcy court approved the plan to terminate nearly 800 dealer franchise agreements. General Motors is also cutting off hundreds of dealers, but a handful of them can stay on. GM says up to 20 dealers will be allowed to stay open. All told, GM is ending deals with some 1,100 dealerships.
A tiny island halfway around the world is rocking Guantanamo Bay this morning. The Pacific island of Palau says it's going to take in up to 17 Guantanamo Bay detainees. The prisoners are Chinese Muslims, members of the Uyghur minority. The Pentagon says they were not enemy combatants. They said that some time ago, but they can't be released back to China because they might face persecution there. So a court ordered them released to the U.S., but that was politically unpopular. The U.S. is still looking for countries to take dozens of other Gitmo detainees cleared for release. And Iraqi officials say at least 32 people are dead, dozens more wounded after a car bomb ripped through a market in the country south. The blast hit in a Shiite area. It's the latest in a series of high-profile explosions rocking the country, and the U.S. military is preparing to leave Iraqi cities by the end of the month.
A French sub is on the scene of the Air France Rio to Paris flight. In the ocean, the water is deep and the terrain is rocky, and they're looking for the flight recorders. Searchers aren't sure they'll ever find those recorders, but they're using everything they can get their hands on to try. This sub will try to pick up sounds from those recorders. They reportedly ping for about 30 days. Hockey Stanley Cup all tied up at 3-3. Decisive Game 7 coming up on Friday for the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Detroit Red Wings. The S&P and the Dow didn't change much yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 942. The Dow begins at 8763. The futures trading shows an up market when Wall Street opens in about a half hour. So if you had a judge's powers and could sentence a white-collar criminal to something, say, a little creative, what would you do?
I think that people convicted of crimes related to the financial crisis should help people who have been foreclosed move their possessions and family to shelters.
Give us your take. Be the judge. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We talked to a judge this morning who sentenced criminals to write books. What's your take?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin in Pakistan this morning, where the death toll stands at least 18. A bomb blast yesterday destroyed part of a luxury hotel in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. And two foreign nationals working for the United Nations are among the dead. Chris Morris is the BBC's South Asia correspondent. He joins us from Islamabad with the latest. Chris, first of all, the aftermath of this bombing, what are we learning?
Well, it was directed against what was a very symbolic target. I think that's the main thing. This was the most prominent hotel in Peshawar. It was a place where government dignitaries would go and stay, where any foreign aid workers, foreign diplomats venturing to Peshawar would go and stay. So it was certainly targeted for being a link between Peshawar and the outside world. What happened, and we've seen it now on CCTV footage released by the authorities, is that late last evening, a car drew up to a security barrier at the perimeter of the hotel, shots were fired, and in the confusion, both the car and a truck behind it smashed through the barrier, and a few seconds later, you see a huge flash, the explosion, as the bomb hidden inside the truck, we believe, detonated right next to the hotel building.
Chris, we're seeing this battle playing out on two fronts almost. The Taliban seems to be focusing on these high-profile symbolic targets, whereas the Pakistani military and its offensive against the Taliban is focusing on a village-to-village kind of rollback. Is that what you're seeing?
Very much so. I mean, in the last couple of days, I mean, fighting has really spread across northwest Pakistan. There's been this big offensive, as you probably know, in the Swat Valley, where the military has been pushing the Taliban back. We've had reports in the last couple of days of more fighting in a place called Upper Deer, where helicopter gunships have been in action in support of a local militia. And then, intriguingly, in a place called Banu, which is next to Waziristan, a fairly famous name these days, a stronghold of the Taliban, and a place where many people suspect leaders of Al-Qaeda may have sought sanctuary. What's not clear is whether this new operation is a prelude to an operation inside Waziristan itself, something that certainly Pakistan's Western allies, in particular the US, would like to see, because they're worried that as more American troops in the US surge move into Afghanistan, that if they're put under pressure, they'll simply come across the border into Pakistan. If they're under pressure here as well, that will be more difficult.
Well, following all the developments, Chris Morris, BBC South Asia correspondent, joining us. Thanks for that from Islamabad, Pakistan. And, of course, it's a reason to grab a map. All of those places may not be so familiar to you, but they are very familiar to some people who are watching these developments very closely here in the United States. Joining us now, Mohammed Razi, Executive Director of the Council of People's Organization, a nonprofit here in New York that serves the South Asian community and also tries, as we are, to follow the details of these events halfway around the world. Mohammed, we're very glad to have you in the studio with us. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Frank.
Thank you.
What media source do you rely on to follow, first, the bombing, second, this the tactics going on in this military offensive of Pakistan, and then finally, where the displaced people are?
We follow the news as coming from Geo News, which is an international news station from Pakistan, and also ARY. ARY One.
I see.
And they actually try to keep up with what's happening, and they have news crews that are going in and near those vicinities.
What about direct digital contact with the people who may be displaced, family members, via cell phone, via computer? Is that even possible here?
Well, the cell phone actually is possible, and that's what's really helpful, because the landlines, there are none. I mean, the electricity, everything is just shot. And cell phones is the only one that goes back and forth sometimes.
Now, when I hear Swat Valley, I think of a war zone. When you and your family and compatriots think of the Swat Valley, what picture comes to your mind?
The picture that comes to our mind is, it was such a nice place, to visit. It was a nice place for them to have their family members. Like right now, we're about to have schools that are going to go out of school. Kids are going to go out of school, and they were usually the families. They go back to their country, and they go visit family members. All of a sudden, they can't do that, and it's just devastating them.
Where are people going? 2 million displaced people. We've heard there's a lot of sort of joining family members inside other places in Pakistan, but are there people leaving the country altogether?
Well, no, they are not able to leave the country altogether. I mean, that's one of the things we were bringing up with the congressman, that when we met with them, that, these displaced families should have refugees coming to the States, because they are, Pakistan can only take so much. It doesn't have all these facilities available for these, refugees at all. And it's just, it's very stressful that these community members who were living, in the region, and all of a sudden now they're, 2 million. That's just unbelievable.
Well, following up on that, every region of the world has people who come to the U.S. at different times for different reasons, as immigrants, as refugees, temporarily for education. With the Pakistani-American community, is there a large refugee population, or has it been mostly voluntary immigration without refugee status?
It has been voluntary immigration without refugee status. Mostly.
Do you think that should change or could change?
Currently, I think we should have... In this situation, we should change, because we are actually, what I'm saying is, as we as the Americans and Pakistan working together in infiltrating these insurgents and these Talibans, we have to prove to the communities that are there, that are being displaced, that we are here to help as well.
The interesting thing is this relationship that you have both to the displaced community and also to the authorities in Pakistan. If you hear the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Yusuf Razi Gilani, saying this, tell me what your reaction is. Listen.
I appeal to the international community that they should help Pakistan to look after the internally displaced persons.
Now, of course, I hear that, and as a news reporter, journalist, and as, I suppose, a Caucasian, I'm thinking USAID, the State Department, international aid. But when you in your communities and your living rooms and households hear that call for the international community to help, what is it that you think?
Well, when we are hearing this type of, you know, outcry, we're like, we're trying to figure out what are other countries that can help us. I mean, it has to be. It's not just, it shouldn't be a burden just on the United States at all. I mean, yes, we are at the forefront of this, but it also should involve, you know, Britain. It also should involve other countries, you know, of common concerns.
What about tangibly in your individual families? Are there ways for you to help, and are there difficulties and obstacles to reach the people who are displaced?
There is. It's a very difficult situation. We work with other organizations like Haber Society, putting funds together, individuals, and those individuals, they actually take the funds in those regions and try to disperse the funds and getting tents and food and water and so forth.
You know, a lot of Americans, I think, might have difficulty understanding why the Taliban would have a hold in a place like the beautiful Swat Valley, as you describe it, where, as you say, this has been traditionally a peaceful place, and then all of a sudden the Taliban come in. Why would a village embrace the Taliban under any circumstances, if that's even happening?
Well, what happens is, as you're aware, in many of these third world countries, they really have no funding for their children, for schools, and these so-called Talibans, they had some sort of funding available, wherever that may be. But they are able to use that funding perhaps to open up small schools or these madrasas, which are called. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, the villagers, they see, oh, at least my kids are studying. And they're not realizing what they're studying, you know, whether it's a particular version of Islam, the way the people want, the Taliban want them mm-hmm. to be. And that's what happens. I mean, they see a way out to help these, they're seeing it as a way of help. And now we have to figure out, we're getting rid of them, but we have to give this humanitarian, we have to put them back together.
We've had many people on reporting from Pakistan, and I remember asking one of them, how are people in the U.S. or the U.S. government perceived? And right now they're not so good,
yeah,
not so
good
much.
Yeah.
What role do Pakistani Americans play in trying to navigate the relationship between these two countries?
Well, the most important thing is the Pakistani Americans that are here. They always emphasize, because many times when things happen, community members from Pakistani family members, they call here and they're like, oh my God, is everything okay in the States? And we assure them everything is perfect here. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, when you guys go out in the street and you're demonstrating against the United States, that's totally wrong. That is totally wrong. You have to figure that out. That's extremely wrong. That's not the, you know, that's not the right path. And we are always emphasizing that.
Well, a difficult path to navigate, certainly. Mohammed Razvi is the executive director of the Council on People's Organization, a nonprofit here in New York that serves the South Asian community, thinking about what's going on in the Swat Valley, where 2 million people, it's estimated, are displaced, and the entire nation recovering from a horrific bombing that we reported on earlier this hour. It took place yesterday.
Yeah, very, very sad, very serious stuff. And we have been talking about a different topic entirely. A judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of the punishment. Now, we've been asking, what would you do if you had those superpowers?
Any kind of community service would be good, whether it's cleaning up highways alongside of the prisoners that I see, or perhaps if they still have a lot of money left, they could take out orphans or underprivileged children, expose them to the world, take them to some nice places.
Tea at the Mark, maybe, or, you know, Museum Day? I don't know. Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Your sentence, Mr. Madoff, count all the grains of sand in the Sahara. Yeah. If you had a judge's power and could sentence a white-collar criminal creatively, what would you do?
Hello, my name is Carmela. I think the criminals who brought the economy down should have to do cafeteria duty for 6 months in either a high school or a middle school.
That's better. Your take at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
It is finals time for the NBA and the NHL. The Pittsburgh Penguins grabbed a 2-1 victory over the Detroit Red Wings on the ice, forcing a Game 7 in the Stanley Cup Finals. Meanwhile, in basketball, Orlando finally found its magic touch with a 108-104 win over the LA Lakers last night. They'll face off in Game 4 on Thursday. We're going to get all the details from our friend, the Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, I'm going to lay it on the line here. I haven't been watching the games. I've been reading about them, but what am I missing by not watching this week?
The Orlando Magic had one of the best. They had literally the best shooting percentage of any NBA team in a finals game history. Yesterday, they had a balanced scoring attack. All five of their starters scored in double figures. It was if you wanted to see team basketball, if you wanted to see a lot of passing, they spaced the floor. The Orlando Magic did it, and they won for the first time in their franchise history. They won a finals game.
You know, this was a blowout in the first game. The Lakers won. Then they seemed to get their act together, the Magic, and now they really clamped down. This is exactly what happened to the Cleveland Cavaliers. They shut down the star, LeBron James. Are they shutting down Kobe Bryant of the Magic?
Well, I think you can. I don't know if you can shut down Kobe Bryant right now. Kobe was on fire in the first half. He shot a blistering percentage early on. He scored like 17 points in 5 minutes, but then he missed his own shots. So I think with a guy like Kobe, you're going to defend him well, and then he misses shots.
Hmm. Well, here's a little bit of what Kobe Bryant had to say.
My rhythm was off. My rhythm was just off at the free throw line. I just shot poorly from the charity stripe. It's a bad night.
Whoa. You know, this series is about team basketball versus the NBA star system, really.
Well, there was when someone makes a foul and then people are like, no, it wasn't a foul. And then they miss the free throw shot. People say, the ball doesn't lie. The ball doesn't lie. And yesterday, Kobe had a play where it was a little questionable. And it was a game, you know, it could have clinched the game for them. And he missed it, went in and out. That was not very Kobe Bryant-like.
All right, so a four-point lead. Okay, they only won by 4 points. Even with this incredible shooting percentage, what do you predict for the next game?
Now they have to continue to spread the floor. The Magic have to continue to spread the floor. Guys like Odom and Ariza for the Lakers have to step up a little bit on the defensive end. But I think what the Magic are doing, they're getting serious about who's going to be their point guard ongoing. They had a little debate between Skip DeMilu, Rafer Alston, and Jameer Nelson trying to figure out which one. They stuck with Skip DeMilu. He brought them to the finals. I think if you stick with that formula, I think the Magic are going to take game four, and it's going to make the series a little bit more interesting.
A lot more interesting, that's for sure. Let's shift to hockey. Take me to the last 2 minutes of that game.
Well, then you got the last 2 minutes was Detroit trying to actually win the Stanley Cup, and they just came up a little bit short.
Detroit is looking for some good news in this series. Bring us up to there's a pivotal Game 7 that was forced last night by the Pittsburgh Penguins. The Red Wings favored, but it was looking pretty iffy last night.
Well, here's a little bit pivotal moment you're talking about. Dan Cleary on a breakaway with less than 2 minutes to play.
Zetterberg and Malkin. Orpik. But Datsyuk laid a hit for Cleary. Moving on in. Getting a piece of it was Fleury.
That was exciting.
Of America was not watching.
It was not watching. I think if you Cleary had to score that goal, that was the critical moment in the game. But Fleury stopped it. Osgood on the other side had 29 saves on his own self. The name of the game last night on that ice was defense, defense, defense.
Does this series do anything for the business model of the NHL? It's been a very exciting series. Detroit is certainly the Cinderella.
Well, you have a guy like Scuderi in the very end for the Pittsburgh Penguins who's backing up his goalie who falls out of the space, and he blocks three pucks as they're starting to go in. Under that 1 minute, that's exciting hockey, and I think it'll do amazing things for the sport.
Right. Now, you know, I actually have one question. Is Roger Federer a robot? You would know. You would actually know, right? You won the French Open.
Federer was bawling like a baby. He's no longer a robot. He's actually a real human being.
You know, that is true. That is, you know, sobbing when he wins, sobbing when he loses. Harvey Ayrton in the New York Times had a great column this week about how human Roger Federer actually is. He's no Yvonne Lendl. He is very human.
It was a touching moment when he won, and now he can stake claim to be close to Rod Laver. In sort of tennis lore. We'll see how it goes from here.
All right, I have to ask you one more thing. We've had this running gag about trying to get on each other's Twitter feeds. Have you seen the amount? I think like 40% of the Twitters right now or the tweets are probably about these sports series.
Without question, there's a lot of really amazing people to follow. The Real Shaq, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. If you follow their tweets, you get a real sense. You can actually probably follow the NBA Finals on Twitter.
You can create your own sports center 24 hours a day digitally. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much for being here. Of course, the Takeaways sports contributor and all-around sports friend.
Well, I have to admit, I am not always the most sports attentive person, but I am so Twitterific. And, you know, it's funny when I think about Twitter, and I am at Farai Chidea. I am online all the time with P. Diddy and all these other people, and all they can tweet about is sports. And there was someone who was tweeting, actually, from a wedding, saying, "Why can't this reception be over? I have to go watch the game." I thought that was hilarious. Femi.
Thank you very much. Time for some news headlines at 28 minutes past the hour. Chrysler's bankruptcy case could wrap up today after a federal judge said the car company could immediately end relationships with almost 800 of its franchisees. And that includes an Illinois dealership where Betty Jo Rosen works. She was distraught when she heard the news.
I'm praying every day for somebody to realize what's going on. It's just so wrong. And to do something to stop the cycle from happening. I mean, where's hope? Where's believing in what we voted for?
Fiat says that it will finalize its deal with Chrysler as soon as the company's court case is over. General Motors has a new head. Former AT&T CEO Edward Whittaker Jr. was handpicked by the government's auto task force to lead GM as it emerges from its bankruptcy. The Boston Globe reports that the New York Times company has hired Goldman Sachs to manage the possible sale of the cash-strapped paper. The report says that Goldman Sachs is accepting bids for the Globe, and the New York Times company owns our partner, the New York Times. In international news, China's state media is calling the country's first gay pride festival a profound success. The China Daily newspaper praised Shanghai for hosting the event, saying that China's government and media needed to do more to promote acceptance for lesbians and gays. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks so much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and we have been talking this morning about a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. Now, if you had this judge's powers, who would you sentence? What would you sentence them to?
Billionaire white-collar criminals should be forced to convert all their dollars into pennies and then to hand-roll them into 50-cent packets. Then they should deliver their heavy packets of pennies to a charity of the judge's choice.
That's a double life sentence.
Yeah, that, I think that you got to add to that then they would have to unwrap the pennies and put them in one of those Coinstar machines and convert them back into dollars. But anyway, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That is your take, your take, your take. We want to hear what you would do if you got to judge a white-collar criminal. non-coercive, non-torture pleas. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org, John.
So the powers of judges are very much on the minds of Guantanamo Bay detainees this morning. There's a lot of news there. The remote Pacific island nation of Palau says it has agreed to a U.S. request to temporarily resettle up to 17 Chinese Muslims now held at the Gitmo Detention Center. The first Guantanamo Bay detainee, meanwhile, to face trial in the United States, pled not guilty in a New York City federal court yesterday. Tanzanian Ahmed Galani is accused of helping to coordinate the 1998 bombing of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Recall the aftermath of that horrific crime in 1998.
It was quite chaotic inside the embassy. The air was filled with smoke and dust, and it was very difficult to see. We could hear some people crying that were lying under a collapsed wall. Myself and a Marine and one of the women that works there at the embassy were able to lift the wall and pull her out. Her legs looked like they were very badly damaged and cut. Everywhere we went, people were soaked in blood.
You can hear the sirens from the scene, a report from the scene in 1998 when the Tanzanian U.S. Embassy was bombed. Also, the Kenyan Embassy, the U.S. Embassy to Kenya in Nairobi, was bombed in 1998. And Ahmed Galani is on trial for his part in those crimes. Joining us is Jonathan Mahler, author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Jonathan is a friend of The Takeaway and a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Let's begin with Galani, Jonathan. And by the way, good morning.
Good morning.
This case, I think a lot of Americans might be surprised that we're still doing that 1998 case.
Yeah.
How important is this, and when was he apprehended?
Yeah, he was apprehended in 2004. And, you know, it's in terms of the importance of the case, it's sort of hard to overstate it. I mean, this is really, if President Obama is going to manage to close Gitmo and also sort of make all of his supporters on the left who've become somewhat unhappy with how he's handled some of these war on terrorism issues, if he's going to satisfy them, this is what he's going to need to do. He's going to need to start moving detainees into our federal court system and trying them there. And I think, you know, Gailani, if you look at him, seems like a good choice because, I mean, one of the main concerns about having suspected terrorists in the federal court system is that they'll sort of turn the trial into a spectacle, which is sort of what Zacharias Moussaoui did a number of years ago.
Right, sure.
And Gailani is a guy who's already apologized in the courtroom on Guantanamo Bay. He's already apologized for what he did, though he said he had no idea what he was doing, that he was working for Bin Laden but was not aware of this larger conspiracy, didn't know what sort of plans were in the works. So it seems as though with him there'll be little danger of him kind of turning his trial into a kind of a propaganda effort for Al-Qaeda. On the other hand...
Well, then that motivates me to ask, though, I don't want to interrupt, but
sure.
I mean, is this just a show trial, a symbolic trial that kind of shows off the federal courts but really doesn't get into any hard issues?
It won't be. I was going to say, actually, while he seems like a good choice for that reason, we've already seen in his court filings and his not guilty plea that he's planning to allege that he was tortured, that he was interrogated with, quote unquote, enhanced interrogation techniques, which is torture. And he's going to argue, or his lawyers are going to argue, that he was held without representation for quite a while, for years. And he's going to argue that he was never informed of a right to remain silent. So these are fundamental rights in our federal system, but they were not fundamental rights in the military system, the military court system on Guantanamo Bay that President Bush created. So this is going to be a very good test for the federal system, and is going to be a chance to see whether this can work.
Well, your book, The Challenge, is all about, and it's a fairly heroic portrait of the military justice system attempting to deal with the limitations and the problems in this military tribunal system that the Bush administration created.
Right.
Do you think the federal system is up to the task of this, and that the world will see that in federal court, this is a much better way to adjudicate these kinds of crimes?
I think so. I certainly hope so, and I do think so because I really do believe that we can't try these guys in this military commission system. I mean, it's just not going to send the right message to the world to be trying these guys in this essentially this kind of made up court system, and a court system that's already been been defeated at the Supreme Court, has already been ruled unconstitutional and unlawful, and just you know, generally is widely perceived as an unfair system. So, you know, our federal system is the place to do this. We've done this before. We've tried plenty of terrorists in the federal court system. So you know, there is a precedent for that. Now, you know, can I guarantee you that everything is going to go smoothly? No. And there are lots of complicated issues. I mean, a couple of those I've already mentioned. But, you know, there's also the question of classified evidence, evidence that is, you know, critical to or deemed critical to national security. How will that be handled?
Well, that may be answered in the early motions in this case. Ahmed Ghilani is someone who pled not guilty yesterday to the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Nairobi. Jonathan Mahler, thanks for that. He joined us to talk about how important this case is going to be for the rest of the Gitmo detainees. Jonathan Mahler is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and author of The Challenge. And now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, the U.S. envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, has been meeting with Palestinian leaders this morning. And he was talking about that meeting. I'm going to quote him here. America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity and a state of their own. End of quote. Mitchell met with Israeli leaders yesterday. His Middle East trip is part of Washington's push to bring Israelis and Palestinians back to the negotiating table. In the U.S., taking a look at the economy, the U.S. trade deficit edged upward for a second straight month in April as the gap between U.S. imports and exports grew. Analysts say that this actually reflects a rising oil prices. Early this morning, the price of a barrel of oil shot above $70. That's the highest it's been this year. Taking a look at some sports news, the Orlando Magic got their first NBA Finals win last night against the Lakers. Dwight Howard is the Orlando Magic center.
I think we were taking better shots tonight. You know, we didn't rush. We attacked. That allowed us to get some easier shots instead of us shooting the ball with a big guy, Lamar or Gasol, in our face.
Highest shooting percentage for a team in the NBA Finals.
It's a record.
History.
Yeah. The Lakers lead the series 2-1, and in hockey, Stanley Cup final is tied 3-3 after Penguins win last night. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. I mean, how do you measure the English language?
By inches.
Well, you could weigh it. Actually, you could look at the Oxford English Dictionary. It's got 20 volumes or something. It's the benchmark dictionary. It has 600,000 entries. But, you know, in the so-called Internet age, there are probably more dynamic and ultimately more accurate ways of calculating the English language. And one of those is the Global Language Monitor, which searches the net for new words. And the criteria is this. Once a word has been used 25,000 times, not in repetition, hopefully, it recognizes the word. And the firm says that this happens on average every 98 minutes.
Hmm.
That's pretty fascinating.
Let's invent something.
Well, there's a milestone today. The Global Language Monitor has found the millionth actively used word in the English language. And joining us from London to celebrate this milestone, I've got my noisemaker here, is Lawrence Pollard, BBC Arts correspondent. Lawrence, good morning.
Hi there.
So the millionth word, what are you doing for the millionth word day?
Well, it's a fantastic, it's a really, really fantastic stunt, okay, by Global Language Monitor, and congratulations to them as well. I spoke to a lot of dictionary people, lexicographers, they call themselves.
Yes.
They would have a long word for themselves,
yes,
wouldn't they? And a good word as well.
Lexis.
And some of them just kind of like guffawed and went, this is absolute nonsense. But everyone I spoke to said, what a brilliant idea. I wish I'd come up with that idea to sell my dictionary. I should explain a little bit about GLM. They're a Texas base now. They're
right.
Run by a fellow who's got like 25 years in computing and in that kind of world. And what they do, in the old days, you remember that corporations would kind of pay someone to do a media trawl, look through all the papers, see how many times, the Takeaway is mentioned or something like that. And you
yes.
get some idea of your penetration. Now, what GLM does is they do that service, but on the web. And they have this monstrous computer that is bigger than I can imagine and bigger than you could weigh, John.
The size of an iPhone, actually, you know, at this point.
That's true. It might be.
Right.
And what they do is they crawl through web traffic and social networking and blogging and all that kind of thing. And they track these words. Now, what they're basically doing is they're counting their method of counting, and they're saying that their method of counting has come to a million, which is great. But there are other ways of counting.
Well, their method of counting may account for what is the millionth word. Let's get rid of the suspense right now. The millionth word in the English language is...
Web 2.0 or 2.0, depending how you say it. Yeah, but yes, that phrase, which, you know, in case you don't know it, I'm sure you do, began as a technical term. It's now, well,
it's not a word.
No, well, that's true.
But it's not a word.
It means improvement, doesn't it? You know, doesn't your girlfriend say to you, oh, I need a haircut 2.0 or something like that? You know, it's kind
of... My wife's probably thinking about husband 2.0.
Husband 2.0. It's kind of spread out in that way. One thing that we can learn from that is obviously the internet creates a lot of new words. But you've got to bear in mind the other ones that nearly made it. Jai Ho, the Hindi expression,
yeah,
well known
good.
From films. And also Slumdog, which nearly made the millionth. Presumably it's now the millionth and thirst word, which I think is quite an honor in itself. That shows the kind of the Indian influence. There's also a huge Chinese influence. And you've got to bear in mind, I mean, GLM point out that not that long ago, say 50 years ago, there were maybe 250 million who spoke English like we do. Former colonies. Sorry, America, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, lost them.
Gained the language. You gained the language, so you did well. Yeah. But now, rather than 250 million people inventing words and trying to find English ways to express the world around them, there are 1.5 billion.
Right.
So, yeah, you bet there's going to be new words all over the place. But as I say, the interesting thing is that this is them counting, their method of counting.
Right. And the millionth word is Web 2.0. Well, as usual, taking credit for the English language, Lawrence Pollard from our partners, the BBC arts correspondent. Thanks, Lawrence.
My pleasure.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, when we learned that a judge in Washington had sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book about everything he'd done wrong as his punishment, we wanted to ask you the same question. Let's make you a judge. Let's give you the power to sentence however creatively you want a white-collar criminal. And Daryl emailed us, for the book, does anyone know if there was a topic assigned? Can the felon write a kid's book about how to get rich? I think the issue with sentencing prisoners is that they are separated from the damage they've done. Every sentence should involve confronting and helping those directly affected by the crime. Lots of suggestions at our website. Go and look at them and then send us your own at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Femi OK has our headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, the tiny Pacific island of Palau is offering to take up to 17 Guantanamo Bay detainees. The prisoners are Chinese Muslims from the Uyghur minority, and they can't go home for fear of persecution. The White House says that it's confident a Guantanamo Bay detainee can be tried securely in New York. Ahmed Gilani is the first prisoner brought to America. The administration refuses to speculate on what would happen to Gilani if he's acquitted, calling that situation hypothetical. In international news, Iraqi officials say that at least 32 are dead and dozens more wounded after a car bomb ripped through a market in the country's south. The blast hit in a Shiite area. It's the latest in a series of high-profile explosions rocking the country as the U.S. military prepares to leave Iraqi cities by the end of the month. And finally, the Middle East envoy George Mitchell is continuing his regional mission. Today he met with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Yesterday he talked to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And all this comes on the heels of President Obama's speech last week where he promised an active White House role in Middle East peace. That's Look at Your News for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks so much. And yesterday we talked about a law that's going to let the FDA regulate tobacco for the first time. It seems likely to pass. And a controversial issue that came up, it bans all flavored cigarettes except for menthols. Well, it just so happens that menthols are smoked more commonly by African Americans than any other group. 75% of African American smokers buy menthols. The Senate is likely to pass the bill today. We're going to get two views on the bill and African Americans. We'd like to welcome back to the show Representative Donna Christensen. She represents the Virgin Islands and chairs the Congressional Black Caucus's Health Brain Trust. She's also a doctor. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
And also with us, we've got Bill Robinson, Executive Director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network, one of the few organizations to come out against the bill. Thanks for joining us, too.
Good morning.
All right. Representative Christensen, let me start with you. Mm-hmm. There is a long tradition of tobacco companies working hand in hand with African American organizations through funding. The Congressional Black Caucus has not been an organization that has shied away from this. You have had individual members of the Congressional Black Caucus receiving funds. You have also had the legislative conference get donations from Philip Morris. And in fact, Altria, the parent company of Philip Morris, has donated $1.45 million since 2002. Does that taint the mission of the organization?
I don't think so. We've also been strong partners with American Legacy and done a lot of work with them across the country on smoking cessation, despite the fact that the foundation has received a fair amount of funding from Altria. You know, unfortunately, and there are some members who have objected to it. There are some members that don't attend functions that are funded by tobacco or alcohol products. But by and large, it's very difficult for us to carry out our mission. We don't get the kind of funding that other members or other foundations might have. And so we take donations from a wide variety of sources that are willing to support us, but we do not let them dictate to us. I'm just coming off of the board on the foundation. We do not let them dictate to us what our role or agenda should be, and they support projects and programs that the foundation develops independently.
Well, there have been some major critiques of this legislation, as well as some major embraces of it. There was one article published in The Big Money, which is an online magazine. It calls it cool, refreshing legislation for Philip Morris. And they quote a professor at Boston University School of Public Health who says, it's like a dream come true for Philip Morris. First, they make it look like they're a reformed company who cares about reducing the toll of cigarettes. And second, they protect their domination of the market. I'm stating these things because, you know, as someone who represents a community where I'm sure at least some of your constituents are smokers, how do you address the idea that this bill might have a significant loophole? And do you believe it's a loophole?
Well, I'm not sure where that loophole is. And I wanted to say, just for the record, too, that CBC members or anyone at the foundation were not part of negotiating any part of this bill. So, but I'm sorry, where's the loophole?
Well, the question is about menthol.
About menthol. Well, you know, and Mr. Robinson was very, very active, as I'm sure he will say later, opposed to this. And many members of the CBC would have liked to have seen menthol also banned within the bill.
Let me bring in Bill Robinson right now.
Sure.
You're with National African American Tobacco Prevention Network, and you are one of a handful of organizations to come out against this bill. Is the menthol exception part of that?
Yes. The reason why is that 76% of our community smokes mentholated products, and the bill, as it was originally drafted, exempted all candy and fruit flavorings except menthol, and we thought that was discriminatory in its impact, although it may not have been discriminatory in its intent, given the level of smokers in our community that use mentholated products. The result of that is we represent like 5.8% of the about 43.5 million smokers, but we die at a rate of twice that, almost 11%. And I will say that Congressman Christensen especially was one of the people when we went to Congress to address this issue who was very supportive of this initiative and helped us to get a provision added to the legislation that will mandate this new FDA oversight committee to address this menthol issue within the first year after this bill is passed. So we're very happy about that, but we are not going to support the bill at this particular point until we are sure that when it reaches the president's desk, that that provision remains intact.
Now, you know, we've played tape earlier in the show of Dave Chappelle talking about menthol cigarettes, but Kools are a brand that really do have a cultural cachet in a way. Here's a little bit of some of their advertising.
Snow Fresh filter.
Cool. Cool, Snow Fresh, cool, tastes so clean, so refreshing, so cool.
As cool and as clean as a breath of fresh air. The finest leaf tobacco, mild, refreshing menthol.
So what I will say, and this has to be my final question, and to you, Bill, do some people still associate menthol with being healthier? Is that the problem?
Yes, I think it's because people understand the natural properties of menthol, that they're a cooling and soothing sensation. So whether you add it to toothpaste, creams, candies, or whatever it is, you understand that.
Right.
So some people still have this false idea that it is a safer ingredient, but it is
right.
not. And we think that the reason why the tobacco industry negotiated this with this exemption on menthol is because it represents about 23% of the total U.S. market, which then translates to about $19 billion.
And we have to leave it there, but I would like to thank both of you, both of my guests, Bill Robinson, Executive Director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network, and Representative Donna Christensen, M.D., Chairperson of the Congressional Black Caucus's Health Brain Trust. John?
$19 billion talks, apparently, according to those guys. We've been talking today also about a judge who sentenced a white-collar criminal to write a book as part of his punishment. If you were a judge, what sentence could you come up with in a creative moment?
I think that all white-collar criminals, such as bankers and the like, should be forced to walk down Fifth Avenue, stark naked, wearing dunce caps, holding signs that say, "I am a pinhead."
Entertaining, sure, but what about all the people on Fifth Avenue who would be punished for being in the traffic jam watching the pinhead banker executives? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Great suggestions this morning, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. All of our responses are on the website, and you can go to our podcast on the website or at iTunes to subscribe. An update on Chrysler: the automaker has sold its good assets to Fiat. The deal has closed.
Forming a new company. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is your Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.